This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today it is the 1st of May, and if you looked outside, you probably noticed that there weren't any very tall snowbanks anymore. But if you walked outside, you probably noticed it was a little cool as well. This is one of the latest springs ever, and that got us to thinking here at Main Street about spring planting. I'm sure there are some farmers out there who are thinking about spring planting, so we thought we'd bring in an expert. Dwight Ockery is an extension farm management specialist. He works at NDSU, and he has responsibilities covering a broad range of farm management issues, and he joins us to shed some light on spring planting and ultimately perhaps the harvest this year. Dwight, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You yourself actually operate a diversified farm. Is your operation typical or atypical in North Dakota?
First of all, it's in Minnesota.
There you go. That's atypical. North Dakota.
And it's atypical in its size, but for sure, I operate a small operation. It would be on a smaller scale typical of a Minnesota farm, primarily corn and soybeans, and then used to have dairy cattle, but now we've got beef cows.
Is the direction in farming generally toward more specialized farms, or diversification still is the practice?
There's some of both, but I think over the years we've certainly moved towards specialization and specialization on a very large scale. Many of the farms in North Dakota, northwestern Minnesota, probably grow three crops. Not too many of them grow many more than that. And so there's a lot of acres in each crop. A lot of that has to do with better use of the machinery, maximizing the use of any one piece of equipment.
Well, everybody knows how important agriculture is to this part of the country and the economies of northwest Minnesota and all of North Dakota. This late season start, does it affect any of the planting decisions that have been sort of worked over?
I think it does. Hopefully, if we get into the field in the next few days, we won't have to make too many changes. Probably some of the crops that are most impacted would be those early cool season crops like spring wheat, durum, those and barley. Probably those crops, it is starting to get late for particularly for barley. Another crop that may be impacted is canola. But the other major crops in this part of the region, corn and soybeans, not too much yet. Now, there is a lot of talk about corn, but I think most of the agronomists will tell you to stay with your plans for another 2 to 3 weeks.
Now, when do we usually get into the fields in this part of the country?
Well, it obviously varies from year to year, but I think general field work across North Dakota is probably more typical in, the 1st or, say, 20 to 25th of April. So now we're looking at 10 days or more late.
Wow. Okay. What do planting intentions look like? I mean, there have been some published intentions. What have we seen so far?
Right. USDA does a survey in March and come out with the March planting intentions report at the end of March. It showed nationwide a significant increase in corn and stable acres of wheat and a slight decline in soybeans. Since the spring is late, not just here but everywhere in the country, I think there is speculation that corn will drop a little bit, probably level or end up being about where it was last year, and soybeans will probably gain some of those acres. Now, in North Dakota, the planting intentions report was showed a huge increase for corn, and I think that might be tempered a little bit. I think a lot of that increase is further west and north. That's probably not the place to have a late spring. So I think we'll probably see corn acres back down closer to what we had last year.
Nevertheless, corn has been quite a story in North Dakota recently.
Corn has been the shining star for sure.
How closely do planting intentions follow commodity price trends? Do people say, oh, corn's good. Look at how much I can get for a bushel. Let me plant corn.
Definitely there's a close correlation. Now, you have to consider agronomic aspects, decent rotation and so on, but very few people grow one crop. And so if you're growing two or three or four crops, you are going to follow the markets to some extent. And but, you know, what we've seen in the last since 2006, of course, is much higher price levels for all crops. It was led by corn, but because corn went up, the market sensed the need to raise the prices or to let the other prices compete in the marketplace. And so if one rises significantly, it'll tend to, you know, one major crop, I should say, it'll bring up the other crops as well. So we tend to keep a balance across the country as a whole.
Well, your area of expertise is in farm management. And one thing that really intrigues me, and I even found some worksheets that you very helpfully have up on the website for the Extension Service, the kinds of decisions, planning decisions, and investment decisions that a farmer has to make before planting. Give us a sense of that process, and what is the actual rate of return on this investment?
That last part of the question is a tough one to answer, and it varies tremendously. The last two or three years, the rate of return has been very favorable in the mid to upper teens. Mm-hmm. But that's not a long-term rate of return, so I think more in the 5 to 7, 8% would be more typical.
And when you're thinking of the actual cost of doing this, that is a that's a daunting number.
Well, it is.
Until you get to the harvest, you're probably chewing some fingernails.
There's a lot of money on the line.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the decision. The producers are looking at how can we get the greatest return for the dollars invested. And that isn't always necessarily the highest priced crop. And then, if you know, the decisions are long term versus short term. In the short term, it's things like, you know, which crops are we going to grow, which varieties are we going to grow, are we going to you know, change our cultural practices somewhat, and so on. But long term, you're looking at land investment, land rent versus purchasing. We're looking at machinery purchasing decisions, leasing, you know, sizing of equipment. There's a decision to be made every day.
Well, I notice on the worksheet that you go into great detail on what are called direct costs, the seeds, the herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, fertilizer, et cetera. Then you've got indirect costs that are fixed as well, machinery depreciation you mentioned, the investment, the land charge. And when all these things are factored in, what's coming back to the farmer is a lot less.
For sure. For many years, as we did crop budgets, we would see that the return to labor and management was probably in that $25, $30 an acre or less for most all crops. Most recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, it's not uncommon to see $100 per acre return to labor and management. Now, that doesn't mean that's profit, because the owner has to provide for family living off of that labor and management. And, of course, there should be some reward for taking risk. And and so that has to come out of that bottom line.
This time of year, we've had a flood event that was less difficult than we thought it was going to be. But nevertheless, the river's out of its banks. It's not unusual for the Red River or the Cheyenne or the James or the Missouri or the Souris. We have flat land here, and the water goes where it wants to go. And Devil's Lake, of course, the basin there is again filled to overflowing and is likely to get more water yet. So how much property is out of production, I mean, because of this every year?
Well, the Devil's Lake Basin is somewhat unique in that it is a closed basin until it reaches, I think it's 1,458 feet above sea level. Then it will flow into the Cheyenne naturally. But the current point of reference is, I think, the 1993 when the lake was at its low point, and they were, you know, seriously trying to get water from the Missouri into the Devil's Lake, mm-hmm. which, of course, never happened. And since then, it's been growing almost continuously, a little setback last year, but it's been increasing in size. So today, the lake covers about 161,000 acres more than it did in 1993. And so we're, you know, for the last several years now, we've been doing a little bit of a quick study looking at the cost, and we just completed that for this for 2013, and it's phenomenal.
Give us a sense.
The direct losses at the farm level, in other words, the income that won't be realized from not being able to plant 161,000 acres, we estimate to be about $54 million just for this year, 2013. And that's not the only loss, because that $54 million would be spent throughout the economy, most of it locally for inputs and for both short-term inputs as well as long-term trading machinery, et cetera. And so the total impact, when you add the secondary impact, brings it up to about $198 million for 1 year for one lake.
Wow, that's devastating to Devil's Lake in Ramsey County.
It certainly is, yes.
Well, that leads into another area of discussion, though, that sort of is the other side of this, and that's the value of farmland itself. That is skyrocketing. Have you ever seen farmland prices as high as they are now?
Well, not in nominal dollars, but they just barely surpassed the real value that they were back in 1980, about 82.
And that's when everybody was planting wheat for Russia.
They're planting wheat for Russia, and we were right ahead of the crash.
Yeah. So are you saying that, you know, temper your thoughts about farmland value? Or?
Well, I'm not going to predict the crash, but I question how much higher they can go without additional increases in the price of commodities. And right now, the intermediate term look, I would say, looking out to this year as well as next year, that's not in the cards. I don't think anybody is suggesting we're going to see prices above what we had last year, and most everyone is suggesting we're going to be seeing lower prices for this crop and then possibly for the next one. That doesn't suggest there's an ability to pay more for land than we've been paying, because
sure,
it won't cash flow today.
So that should temper the price push up a bit anyway.
It should slow, if not stop, the rise.
But give us a sense. What would it cost to buy 1,000 acres in the Red River Valley, for example?
Well, in the Red River Valley, and it's hard to say. All you need is a sale where two people really want it, and then it goes out of whack. But I think in most of the Red River Valley, the current market might be in that $5,000, $6,000 an acre.
So $5-6 million for that 1,000 acres of land.
You can drop change in a hurry.
And then you can start investing in the seed, the herbicide,
right,
the insecticide, and all
take,
that.
Take all the risk.
So what does this say about family farming?
Family farming is not the old mom and pop Currier and Ives picture of family farming anymore. It's a big business. It's what we're seeing is and this has been happening for a long time, long before this run up in prices, is a significant amount of consolidation. And what happens is individuals retire. If there's no one in that family, or someone else that close to them that is wants to take over or is able to take over, it gets rented and eventually purchased by larger and usually neighboring farmers. And this has been going on for a long time. I don't see anything stopping it in the future. So I think what it means is that, we'll still have family farms, but if you don't have a good foothold today, you're probably not going to be a new family starting a farm.
And it does kind of draw attention to what is the distinction between a corporate and a family farm when you get to a certain size.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult to draw a distinction other than where the profits flow to.
Okay. Property taxes, much in discussion in Bismarck. How big a deal is this with farmers?
I work with that and calculate the average value for the counties that is used in that process. And in my personal opinion, it's greatly overblown. Property tax, real estate taxes for agricultural land in North Dakota are quite favorable. Their valued land is valued based on its value of production, in contrast to Minnesota, where it's based on market value. And so it really is not an onerous bill in North Dakota, but politics would suggest otherwise.
Is there a sense of is there a percentage that could be roughly applied to farmland property taxes in North Dakota?
The typical bare land in the valley is if it's valued at $5,000-6,000. It probably, whether it's valued at that or twice that, it doesn't matter because of the way the taxes are calculated. Mm-hmm. They're probably paying $12 to $15 an acre taxes. So I haven't figured out what that percentage would be, but it's not a very high amount.
Okay. How about value-added enterprises in the state? We've had various attempts at making noodles and doing this and that. Is that on the uptick? Is it leveled out, or are there issues?
Well, I think it's slowed down. There's still some projects that are being talked about and worked on. One of the newer ones is Energy Beats. But we've had some successes, some very good successes in the state, and we've had some big failures. And, you know, I think for a while it almost stopped, but I think there's some underlying interest in trying to develop value-added enterprises. And I think that'll always be there. There's a lot of entrepreneurial spirit in North Dakota, and as long as there's investment money to make it happen, somebody will try it.
Okay. When is Dwight going to get on his tractor and do some cultivating on his farm?
Well, if the weather warms up, it might be next week.
All right. Well, here's hoping it is, Dwight.
Thank you.
Dwight Ockery is an Extension Farm Management Specialist with NDSU, and he joins us today to talk about the ever-evolving and changing field of farm economics. We're going to find out about another kind of economics in a moment. We're going to go to the Williston Basin Conference in Regina, Saskatchewan, in a moment.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with legendary white stallions on nature. Then at 8 Central, Nova presents Australia's first 4 billion years, strange creatures. And at 9, bugging Hitler's soldiers on secrets of the dead. And that's followed at 10 by a very special presentation, a documentary honoring the late North Dakota Governor, Bill Guy. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
Well, you're seeing kind of a steady stream of people come from our booth. You know, obviously with us at Williston Economic Development, we're kind of in marketing mode right now. We've got our Rockin' the Bakken stickers out here. We've got Rockin' the Bakken banners. We're handing everything out from highlighters to can koozies to pens.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm talking with Sean Winko. He is the Assistant Director for Economic Development in Williston, and right now he's in Regina, Saskatchewan, because the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference is taking place there this year. What's the turnout like, Sean?
Well, it's pretty steady. We're seeing a steady stream of people come by our booth. It's been pretty steady all day. It's pretty much what we expected. Last I had heard, I thought we were in the neighborhood of anywhere from 1,500 to 1,600 people, I believe, were registered for this event.
Well, the big news for people who are following the Williston Basin has to be the how much the numbers keep going up in terms of reserves that are anticipated to be in the Bakken and the Three Forks, I guess. I'm looking at numbers from 2008, where the U.S. Geological Survey estimated a little over 3.5 billion barrels in those formations. And then this week they come out with more than double that. And yet that's even on the low end of everybody else's guesses. So what's to be made of this, Sean?
Well, I tell you, it's exciting to see those numbers. From a Williston Economic Development standpoint, they're not surprising to us. Williston, you know, as you know, is the center of the activity right now, or the Bakken activity. I would say over 90% of the rigs that are drilling are within a 70-mile radius of Williston. But, you know, the industry has been telling us for a long time that this thing is big, this thing has some legs, and it's got some sustainability to it. So to see the numbers continue to go up and to see these new numbers, it's just exciting because it reinforces what we've been trying to say for the last 5 years.
Well, in the last 5 years, the U.S. Geological Survey has doubled their estimate of recoverable reserves. In this year, the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources, Lynn Helms' number is somewhere between 11 and 16 billion barrels. That's, again, about double what the latest estimate by the USGS is. And Continental Petroleum, which is Harold Hamm's operation and which is a big player in the Bakken, has increased its estimate from 32 to 45 billion barrels. That's just off the charts.
Yep, it is.
So why do these numbers keep going up, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it you can contribute to technology and the advancement of technology and how they're recovering the oil from the shale. There's a lot of things or a lot of factors that can come into play, but as you see, the technology get better, I think you're going to see those numbers continue to increase.
Well, we know that they're doing fracking and horizontal drilling to extract oil from this oil shale. What technological advances have been built on that?
Well, there could be several different things. You know, sometimes you'll hear a lot that the industry will talk about stages, which is they will, stage a frack where they can do anywhere from 1 to 40 stages. And I would say the more stages that you can do, the more recovery efforts you're going to see from the oil coming out of there. Also, you look at the substance that they use, the proppant or the sand that they use in the fracking procedure. They're using different grades of sand and different grades of silicone. I would think that would help create the porousness of the rock a little bit more and see the recovery increase as well. But that's just a few of probably, two dozen different advancements that the industry is working on.
And obviously, as this improves the reserves, they can just pull out more of what's there. So that that makes the recoverable part of the reserve bigger because they can recover more.
Yep, absolutely. And it helps with the economics of a well. Obviously, if you're going to see more return now on the cost that you're putting into a well, it's just what it does for us economics-wise is huge.
No, not that we're really big in being number one, but right now North Dakota's number two in the U.S., right behind Texas in terms of oil production. Is there a possibility that North Dakota will slip into that number one slot?
There's always a talk that there is, a possibility. I'll tell you right now, Texas is still it's still the big player, and we're still a little bit behind. I mean, a little bit of ways away to being that point of being number one. But like I said, if you look at the recoverable numbers, how they've doubled and almost tripled, anything's a possibility for us here in the Bakken.
What is the significance of the North Dakota discovery and the exploitation of the Bakken and the Three Forks for U.S. energy security?
I think it's going to play a big major part, if it's not already playing a major part for energy security. I'll tell you, from us, from an economic development standpoint, from a small community in western North Dakota, we were once a town of 12,000 people. In just a few years, we jumped to over 27,000. We think we're going to 50 or 70,000. And from there, it's anybody's game, but the number's probably going to be pretty much higher as far as our community goes. So it's a huge game changer.
Okay. I know that you're in Regina, Saskatchewan, and, of course, the Bakken goes into a piece of Canada, a piece of Montana, South Dakota, but most of it's in North Dakota. Is there much talk about the XL pipeline there? I mean, elsewhere in Canada, they've got some oil sands they need to move.
Yep. There's a lot of discussion about the Keystone XL. To be honest with you, I have not dealt with that project a lot out of my portfolio in economic development, so I would know just enough to be dangerous to comment on it.
Okay. When people come by your booth, Sean, what do they want to talk to you about?
Well, a lot of times it's just talking about what's going on in Williston and, mainly infrastructure development in Williston, kind of gauging a feel of where we're at. Are we starting to get caught up with the huge demand that we're facing? Rock in the Bakken, our slogan, has always been a big hit, so they always want to pick up one of those Rock in the Bakken bumper stickers. And, a lot of it's just really small talk and networking. With the community and just getting an idea of what's going on.
And how is Regina for putting on a show for you?
I tell you what, it's been a great show as always, the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference. It's always been a good show for us.
All right. Well, good luck there. I know it continues through Thursday. We're speaking with Sean Winko. He is the Assistant Director for Economic Development in Williston, and economic development in Williston is always an understatement these days. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
The news is next.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Senators John Hoeven and Amy Klobuchar met with state and local officials in Fargo to discuss long-term solutions for what has become annual flooding issues in the Red River Valley. Hoeven says authorization for the Red River Diversion Project will be taken up on the Senate floor next Monday in the WERDA bill, or the Water Resource Development Act. He says he and Senator Klobuchar have also been working hard to make sure President Obama is aware of how important it is that plans for permanent protection are realized.
Senator Klobuchar and I actually met with the president on this issue. issue and made it very clear this is a huge priority for both our states and that we need help from the administration as well as help from our colleagues in Congress. That's the authorization side. The other side is the funding side. We did get increased funding for project engineering and design this year, $7.4 million. But we need to continue to get more dollars for the permanent construction. That's why it's so important that the administration work with us to be in the budget. But also, we need that authorization that approves the project so we can go forward through the appropriation process and secure funding.
Klobuchar says she and Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson have been working closely together on getting the farm bill ready for debate, which she says includes provisions for permanent floodwater retention and protection for the Red River Valley. She says though the region has become accustomed to fighting back floodwaters year after year, it's no way to live and that it will take a multi-pronged approach to bring forth permanent solutions. After a long wait, it appears the Red River in Fargo crested early this morning at 33.27 feet, far under earlier projections in a range of 38 to 42 feet. Deputy Fargo Mayor Tim Bahoney says the city plans to talk to the National Weather Service about its forecast methods after coming up far short of the actual crest.
You know, we'd ask them to relook at that now because in light of the events of what happened, it's really hard for us. We wouldn't have had to go to 40, as we all know, and it'd be a lot less preparation for us. So we'll ask the Weather Service to relook at their service and how they do this and if there's a better way of doing it next year.
The National Weather Service says the latest spring flood on record was beyond anything they've ever dealt with and made it hard to get a handle on what level the river would peak at. That and a slow warm-up and dry soil all played a part in how the flood played out for the Southern Valley. And the Mid-American Business Conditions Index for April is healthy.
This was a good report, and a good report for North Dakota as well, although I have to say the North Dakota numbers aren't quite as strong this year as they were at the same time last year, but still very strong for North Dakota.
Creighton University Professor Ernie Goss publishes the monthly report, which is a survey of purchasing managers in the 9-state region. His April report showed a small slip from the March index of 58.2 to April's 56.8. An index over 50 shows economic growth. North Dakota's index for April is at 57.9, which is up from March, but down a little from last April. Goss says North Dakota has outperformed the rest of the region and the rest of the nation since the 2008 recession.
For example, 80,000 jobs compared to pre-recession numbers for North Dakota. I don't know if there is another state in the U.S. that's outperformed North Dakota. And as a result, you've got some labor shortages in some parts of North Dakota. And, of course, you've got some housing issues, housing shortages. And that does restrain the growth. And as the rest of the nation rebounds, economically speaking, of course, then workers are not as incentivized to leave, for example, Ohio or Indiana and move to North Dakota to take some of those very good jobs.
Goss says this week's new estimate of available oil and natural gas from the Bakken and Three Forks formations will help fuel North Dakota's economic growth for some time to come. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. It is biking season, and while it's generally a fun and a healthy activity, cyclists and motorists need to be careful. In children in particular, biking deaths increase by 45% nationwide in the summer months, according to Safe Kids USA. Deaths and injuries can affect even the most seasoned riders. Take this, for example. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is recovering now from shoulder surgery after a fall, his third major bike accident. And while the increased number of bicycles out comes with that, the need for increased vigilance. May is Bike Safety Month, and I'm joined now by Karma Hansen with Safe Kids Grand Forks with tips for everyone who's sharing the road. Karma, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, really young kids aren't really riding on the roads, but there are a lot of biking basics out there. And let's kind of start with what should parents be teaching their kids about biking?
Well, sure. And thank you for that question. The first thing is that as kids do start riding early, even if they're on a trike or a big wheel or something like that in their driveway, we want to encourage them to get a helmet on that child right away. A helmet is the single most effective tool we have to prevent the major injuries that we see from a biking incident. So with that said, a lot of people think, well, my kid doesn't need to have a helmet on. They just ride on the driveway or on the sidewalk. And that's the furthest from the truth, because unfortunately we have seen people come into the emergency rooms with head injuries from a fall off of something as low down as a tricycle. The other thing is if you just kind of make it a rule in your house that if you have wheels on your feet or wheels on your behind, you have to have a helmet on your head, it just starts setting that kind of that role modeling and that precedent that if you're going to be riding, a helmet is it is essential.
I think, I mean, even I catch myself going, well, I'm just riding through the park. There aren't cars in the park. Do I really need a helmet?
Well, and here's where we kind of bring that education to life when we do our presentations in the schools. Out on the road with vehicles is certainly one of the more dangerous places to ride. We do encourage people to look and consider riding on the trails and things like that where there is not as many interactions with motor vehicle traffic. However, I always use a story of a friend of mine who in her senior year of nursing school had a colleague or a classmate of hers who was out riding, and she was on a trail. She was 21 years old, about to graduate from nursing school, riding on a trail, and three people were coming on a bike from the opposite direction. So this gal slid over to the side of that trail in order to make room for the other bikers coming her direction to pass. And the wheel of that bike got caught on the edge of the trail, flipped the bike, and she was thrown into a tree. 3 days later, she died of head injuries from that incident. And so you may be a really good bike rider. You may have a lot of experience, but sometimes we don't always have good car drivers on the road. They might be distracted with cell phones or their music or what's going on in their day. And also, we also can't predict what the road conditions are going to be that you're going to be traveling on. And it doesn't take a very big bump or pothole to turn that bicycle over and cause the person riding on it to go flying. And so it is important that it be worn all the time.
Well, a helmet, I found these stats here on ndhealth.gov. A helmet reduces the risk of head injury by 85%. About 700 people a year are killed in bike-related crashes. 70% of those involve head injuries, and yet only 20 to 25% of bicyclists wear helmets?
That's correct. And we have done observation studies within our community, and I think we're pretty consistent throughout the state. But we see anywhere between, depending on if you're by a school or out on the trails or where you're at, between about 15 and 25%. And so that's pretty average statistic for our part of the country. Now, with that said, when we are looking at selling helmets or distributing helmets to kids, one of the things we say to parents is this: do you have a helmet as well? Because you can never protect your head too much. And again, we get back to that not knowing what the road conditions are or what the other vehicle drivers are going to do and protecting yourself. But the other thing is that it sets a precedent, and it really role models to kids that, you know what, everybody's head is important to protect. And, you know, it's pretty easy to fix a scraped up knee or, to be honest, even a broken bone, not so much a brain injury. And brain injuries can have lifelong consequences, you know, things that you know, that you think of the things a brain controls, from your hearing and your speech and your vision and your ability to move and move your hands, go to the bathroom, think, remember, use good, reasonable thoughts. And so it's important that brain be protected, because if there is damage to that brain, there can be some lifelong consequences from that.
But really, though, it's not enough to just wear a helmet. How should a helmet fit?
That's a great question. And you're right. Having the helmet on properly is key to it functioning properly in a crash. A lot of people put their helmet on like a baseball cap, where it's kind of tipped back on the back part of your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's important that the helmet sit up on the front of your head and be almost parallel with the ground. If you were to take and hit yourself in the, kind of try to hit yourself in the face with your hand, the helmet should protect your hand from hitting your face. It should hit helmet first. So it should sit level with the ground, no more than two fingers above the level of the eyebrows. The straps on the side should come together in a V right underneath your ears. And there's usually a little square piece there that you want to adjust to help those straps stay placed on your head the right way. And then the chin strap needs to be strapped, because if it's not and you go flying off of that bike, the helmet's going to go off with you. And no more than one finger should fit underneath that strap at the level right underneath your chin.
So you can't just wear a football helmet.
That's right. And speaking of football helmet, there are different types of helmets based on the type of activity that you will be doing. On our Safe Kids Grand Forks website, which is safekidsgf.com, we do have a brochure that talks about the different types of helmets. And it is important that you protect the head with the helmet that is designed for that activity. For example, a bike helmet, if you're riding on a bike, you typically tend to go over the handlebars and tip off to the side. And so a bike helmet is designed to protect the tops and the side of your head. As you do things like scooter, skateboard, rollerblade, there's a tendency for your feet to go out from underneath you and you can fall over backwards. And so a multi-sport helmet is designed to come down a little bit further on the back of the head, and it protects the base of the brain. And that's the part that's going to control very important functions, breathing, heart rate, those kind of things. That's the same kind of helmet that we put on a little child called a toddler helmet or a trike helmet for kids that are riding on a tricycle. If you think of a trike, it has one wheel in the front and two in the back, and those kids are prone to tipping over backwards. So again, a multi-sport helmet for scootering, skateboarding, rollerblading is very similar to the young trike helmet or toddler helmet that comes down further to protect the base of the brain.
Well, let's talk about the bikes themselves now. What kinds of things do you need to make sure to know that your bike is in good working condition?
Yeah, each spring, you know, when you get that bike out of the shed or out of the garage, it's good to take it and take a look over it. Oftentimes, bike shops will even do that, or a police station have people that will take a look at your bike, make sure that the gears are working, the brakes are working. The other thing is making sure that you have a bicycle that fits you well. When you sit on the seat of your bike, you should be able to safely put your feet down on the ground. And that's important for when you're stopping, that when you stop, your feet touch the ground so that the bike doesn't tip over. So if you have kids at your house and they you don't want to just hand me down a bike and assume that it's going to fit the child, be sure to put them on the bike and make sure that their feet can touch the ground. And then the other thing that is really important is making sure that there is some type of a reflective material on that bike, be that a light or ride at night. Some city ordinances require that you have a flashlight or a bike light actually on it that's like a headlamp. But at the very least, make sure you've got some type of a reflective material on the bike, on the wheels or the back of the seat, so that you can be visibly seen.
And now, how about when kids progress from riding on the driveway and riding through the parks and actually start going on the road? Is there kind of a general age guideline, or what are the best things before you know your kid is okay to ride on the road?
Well, a couple things kind of go into that, and that's, number one, what are their biking skills? Kids that don't start riding bikes till later may not be as adept at it as kids who start at a very early age. I would say before you let your kids go out on the road itself, go on a ride with them, see what their skills are and their ability to come to an intersection and make decisions that not only somebody on a bike would have to make, but somebody that would be in a motor vehicle. You know, do they know that they have to follow the rules, and if there's a stop sign, they have to stop? Do they know how to do their hand signals with the right, left, and stop so that cars know what they're going to be doing? If you're riding on a bike and on the road, you need to follow the same rules of the road as a vehicle does. So getting that under their belt and making sure they know how to do that. The other thing I would caution about is before they even do get out onto the road, consider taking them out onto the trails. Like we talked about, there's going to be less traffic that they have to navigate around, and they can really develop those skills well before you put them on a road where there is motor vehicles.
Oh, and you mentioned kind of the rules of the road, and those of course apply to drivers as well. And you know, I couldn't find all that much on bicycle laws.
Well, unfortunately, there are not a laws within the state of North Dakota about bikes. There are some city ordinances in some of the major cities within our state, and some of those things pertain to, you know, where a bicycle can ride on a sidewalk versus where they are required to be on the street. It might have to do with whether they have to have a headlamp displayed on their bike if they're riding after dark and that kind of thing. There are no communities in the state of North Dakota who currently have a bike helmet law or an ordinance. And so that is something that, you know, while we can say we want to work with our city councils or our state to get a bike helmet law, you know, yes, that is certainly something that could be undertaken. But the reality is that my goal is really to have people do things because it's the right and the safe thing to do, not because a law tells you that you need to. And, you know, I say you wouldn't go out and play football without a helmet. You wouldn't play hockey without the right pads. Why would you go ride a bike without a helmet? And so if we can work within the system to educate the public and people and have parents setting good role models and examples, you know, maybe we can get by without a law because we don't have very many of them in our state right now.
Common sense is sometimes a little bit not so common.
Right, right. And, you know, if you have any people that are child care providers that are out there listening, we've worked with a lot of our local child care providers here in town where we have said if you have bikes within your system, it's great to have helmets that you can put on the kids, because really anytime, it goes back to that, anytime you have wheels on your feet or wheels on your butt, you should have a helmet on your head. And so those centers are doing a really good job of providing helmets within our community so that the kids, again, grow up with that mentality that if I'm going to get on that big wheel or I'm going to get on that bike, that I need to have a helmet on my head.
And cyclists aren't the only ones out there who have to be worried about bicycle safety. What kinds of things should motorists keep in mind?
Well, when you are driving, be cognizant. A lot of times there's big blind zones around vehicles. And so before you do make a turn, look real carefully and watch for a cyclist that may be coming. The other thing I would say is if you have kids within, even if you don't have kids in your neighborhood, it's a good habit to get into that before you back out of a garage or a driveway to take that walk around the vehicle or to look real carefully around the backside of that vehicle. A bike or a young child, a child on a trike would be really easy to miss. So think about where the blind zones are around your vehicle. The other thing is if you park your car and you get it, you're getting out, look before you get out and open that door so that you don't open that door into somebody that may be an oncoming bicyclist that may be on the street. And then remember that those cyclists have the same right of way on the roads as motor vehicles do. And so it is important that we learn how to share the roadway with them. And while they may be going slower than you, it is important that you give them space. And we say about 3 to 4 feet at a minimum is the closest you should get to a cyclist on the road.
And more cyclists on the road, usually because it is getting a little bit nicer out. Just briefly here, what are some other kinds of things to keep in mind for seasonal safety, like kids going out to playgrounds?
Yeah, well, we're hopefully the snow finishes its melt and the playgrounds dry up a little bit. We're seeing kids out and about a little bit more trying to get out of the house. When you are on a playground, a couple things to keep in mind. Bike helmets should never be worn on a playground. There is a certain spacing requirement between the bars to make sure that if the head goes through that the chest can fit through and a child can't become entrapped on a playground. Make sure you take a bike helmet off or a backpack off there. And then the other thing that's really critical for playground safety is the surfacing that is below the playground. Most kids don't die on playgrounds, but we have seen some pretty nasty injuries from kids who fall. And so the surfacing material below your playground should be a minimum of 9 inches. Recommended is up to 12 inches. So if you have a playground and the kind of the sand has been brushed away or the wood chips after a long winter or it's become compacted down, we would encourage you to get out and freshen that up by adding some new surfacing below the equipment that kids are on.
All right. Good tips as always.
All of this information about playground safety and bike safety, driver safety, sharing the roadway, how to select a proper helmet, the right type, all of that information can be found on our Safe Kids website, and that is safekidsgf.com. And if you can't remember that, you can always access it from the All True Health System webpage as well.
All right. Karma Hansen is with Safe Kids Grand Forks. Karma, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. And encourage your listeners to like us on Facebook, too. And we'll post a couple bike safety tips today and some playground ones, too.
And while you're on Facebook, go ahead and like Main Street. We're Main Street at Prairie Public. And one other thing to keep in mind here, Bike to Work Week is May 13th through 17th. Bike to Work Day is Friday, May 17th. And Bike to School Day is May 8th. Ride safely, of course.
Absolutely.
Hey, Peter Sagal here, and if you're not busy on May 2nd, I was hoping you'd like to come to the movies with me. Wait, don't tell me. We'll be broadcast live to movie screens all over the country. Come on, it'll be fun.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio.
Well, I have to hand it to Tom Ezern, the NDSU history professor, has a very intriguing title for this week's Plains Folk column. It's Stories You Haven't Heard Before.
Sometimes I admire single-minded people capable of sustained focus. They seem to accomplish a lot by sticking to an agenda, methodically ticking things off. I do admire these people, and I hate them. Well, maybe hate is too strong a word. Maybe not. For the rest of us, there is another way of bumbling our way into insights and accomplishments, which is to do a large number and great variety of things over a long period of time so that they begin to articulate and resonate with one another. If you're lucky, the result is a mashup that exceeds the sum of the parts. One of the parts to which I've given attention over past weeks is a series of public forums sponsored by the North Dakota Humanities Council on the lasting legacy of the Dakota War in Dakota Territory, reflecting on how the violent events of the early 1860s are significant to us today. Native scholars such as Tamara St. John, LaDonna Allard, and others, along with individuals attending the forums, have provided a marvelous re-education in how we might look at these destructive and formative events. At the same time, I've been working through another senior seminar in history at NDSU, a research class devoted to the Dakota War, each student researching some episode or aspect of the conflict. As they bore deep, I have the advantage of reading all the studies, discussing them, and connecting them up to achieve understandings no individual could achieve alone. That's the nature of a seminar if it's working right. Then in early April, I pushed aside other duties to compose and then deliver my presidential address for the annual meeting of the Western Social Science Association in Denver, the Queen City of the Plains. This was an opportunity to inflict on a large group of professional peers my philosophical approach to doing prairie history, which has evolved over just about 40 years of professional experience. The result was an address entitled Agency, Complexity, Memory, A Scholarship for Western Places. I think it went pretty well, but then I didn't have to sit through it. So all these things, the multiple conversations about the Dakota War, the big speech, and other things I may not even be aware are happening, are mashing up into a larger and revisionist view of what happened during the war that sprawled across the Dakota Plains in 1862 to 64. And that one word, agency, is driving the new view. Here's what I said out in Denver about this philosophical approach to prairie history. I'm talking about the capacity of people and peoples to dream dreams, to make decisions, to act autonomously, and to live with the consequences as they navigate the passages of history. The scholar of agency rejects determinisms, environmental or any other kind. History is constituted by the actions of people and peoples as they navigate, confront, or otherwise interact with such forces and with one another over time, making choices all along the way. Now, over the years, we have assumed that during the Dakota War, agency, that is, the capacity to make history, lay with people like Henry H. Sibley and Alfred H. Sully, who are assumed to be exercising the initiative. Toggle the switch and look again, and we find that instead, it was Dakota people who were exercising the initiative, who were making history in the 1860s. They just didn't do so well about writing it down. In coming weeks, I'll be telling some stories from the Dakota War, stories spangled across the landscape of Dakota Territory, stories with agency, told like you haven't heard them before.
That's Tom Ezern with his Plains Folk column coming up, Dakota Datebook.
Support for this program is provided by Beaver Creek Archaeology of Bismarck, providing cultural resource services to private and public businesses throughout the Great Plains, including mitigation, GIS analysis, historic investigations, and artifact preservation.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 1st. They used to be people of a small cow town along the Missouri River. The town used to have a lovely rodeo grounds that were well known across the nation, and they used to have tall cottonwoods along the river. The town also used to have a local government. On this date in 1953, however, it did not, and it seemed as though the name of Sanish would disappear beneath the waters of Lake Sakakawea forever. Just the day before, on April 30, 1953, the villages of Sanish and Van Hook dissolved their local governments. Sanish was to be inundated by the waters of the Garrison Reservoir, and preparations were already taking place on a wheat field up on the plains for the establishment of a new town. Van Hook was to be only partially inundated, but its trade area would be entirely flooded. The townspeople thought there was no future for the town without that trade, so Van Hook decided to sell out to the Army Corps of Engineers and join Sanish in the new town. It seemed like a good idea since both were small and could join forces and populations to make a modern little city, but egos and hard feelings would soon get in the way. When the new town site was chosen, many people in Sanish were unhappy. The businesses from Sanish and Van Hook would have to compete with each other for business and lots, and Sanish wanted to choose its own town site, not relocate to where the Corps wanted them to. After all, Sanish had to move. Van Hook did not. Even more, they would not keep the name Sanish for the town. When things didn't work out as some of the Sanish residents wished, the disgruntled residents of Sanish decided to band together for what they felt was right. On September 8, 1950, they formed the Sanish Protective Association, or the SPA. Later coined a militant group by the Minot Daily News, the SPA criticized the wrongs they felt they suffered from the Corps of Engineers and the city of Van Hook. In a letter to William Langer, one of the members of the SPA wrote, "We do not hesitate to charge that Van Hook did not appreciate the help Sanish gave them to enable the portion of their town to be bought. Sanish would have been better off if they had refused the help Van Hook asked for. Van Hook proceeded like the proverbial camel who stuck his head in the door to get warm and ended up by entering the tent and pushing his master out, so we feel as though we have been dealt with unfairly." Instead of joining these camels and other Sanish residents in what would later be named Newtown, the SPA moved their families and businesses atop a bluff that now overlooks the Four Bears Bridge. They set up a new city government and lived peacefully in New Sanish until the mid-1970s. Today, Sanish does not have its rodeo, nor its cottonwoods, or its city government, but it did retain its name and the stories of yesteryear, when Sanish was in its heyday, a lively little cow town on the Missouri River. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Tessa Sandstrom. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Thursday on Main Street, our summer blockbuster movie preview features Prairie Public's resident critic Matt O'Lean with two of his film festival colleagues and film-going friends, Tony Tilton and Brittany Goodman. Are you ready for more Superman? I think they're calling it Man of Steel. Are you ready for more Iron Man? They're calling it Iron Man 3. Are you ready for another Gatsby? And there'll be other titles that we maybe have never heard before that we'll hear about tomorrow. And we'll also have Ashley Thornburg in here to look at what else is happening around the region. So join us for Main Street tomorrow. And in the meantime, have a great evening.